Some of you will already have heard this story. It comes from the Zen literature, involves the teacher Ikkyu. I imagine I'm mispronouncing his name, so my apologies. I assume from the way the story is told that he was already in the middle of a calligraphy session when the action starts. Doing calligraphy is not like having a ballpoint pen on your desk and you just sit down and start writing. You have to make the ink, for one thing, when you do calligraphy. That can easily take 15 to 20 minutes. Paper was expensive, not all that easy to come by in the 1400s when Ikkyu was teaching. Anyway, there was Ikkyu in the middle of a session, and someone asked him something like, "Master, will you please write for me some maxims of the highest wisdom?" So one of the great things about stories like this is how sparse they are. Why would someone ask this? Did they really want to get some truth? They really wanted to get some wisdom? Or did the guy want to take home a souvenir? Was he looking after a wall hanging, maybe? So as his answer to this question, Ikkyu dipped his brush in the ink and wrote a single Japanese kanji. That's just one of those symbols that to us Westerners look so mysterious. Anyway, we translate it as attention. The questioner was not impressed and asked, "Will you not add something more?" This is what makes me think he wasn't necessarily after the wisdom. I suppose he thought one kanji wouldn't make a very impressive wall hanging. So Ikkyu then wrote twice running, "Attention, attention." Well, this got the questioner a little bit irritable, apparently, and he criticized the teacher. I really don't see much depth or subtlety in what you have written. So then Ikkyu wrote the same word three times running. And I imagine him dipping his brush slowly in the ink, raising it toward his valuable paper, watching his brush move across the paper. Attention, attention, attention. Now, what about this questioner? Finally, did some curiosity finally start to arise? He asked, "What does that word mean, attention?" And Ikkyu answered, "Attention means attention." A story like this will make some people nod up and down and say, "Oh, yes, of course." Others are going to be like, "What? Attention means attention? How is that profound? Or even a teaching? Don't I already know what attention is? Don't I already pay attention? I pay attention to things all day. I know what attention is. And I know that attention means attention. I mean, that's kind of a dumb story." Well, if you are pretty sure you know everything you need to know about attention, this episode is probably not for you. But if you think there's something to learn in all this, please listen on. There's this book I really like. It's been very helpful to me over the years. It's called Zen and the Psychology of Transformation by Hubert Benoit. Another name I'm probably mispronouncing. I'll put a link in the show notes. There's a chapter in that book that ends with this story of Ikkyu and attention. And that's what I want to talk about today. Hello, and welcome to the 10 Crutches podcast. My name is David. I'm glad you're here. One of the models that I like to work with is that our consciousness is constructed out of parts. It's kind of like looking at a hand or any part of the physical body. You can take the larger structure and think about it as it is, or start to break it down. You can think about a hand and all the many things a hand can do, or you can think about what the hand is made of, bones and blood vessels and nerves, all things like that. So clearly, you can't have a hand without the blood vessels passing through a heart and lungs. You have to have nerves that go to a brain, etc. But just like you can isolate the hand to think about what it does, you can isolate the tendons, the cartilage, the nerves, et cetera, et cetera. When you look at a human mind, you can think about the larger structures like a memory, a fantasy, awareness of a sensation. What happens in the mind when you hear a single simple thing, like you just heard the chirp of a bird? What happens if you start to break that simple act of hearing down? What are the components of a single act of hearing a single thing? At some point when looking at a red blood cell that's traveling through your hand, you have lost sight of the hand. Certainly, if you look at the molecular structure of a red blood cell in the hand, now you've really lost sight of the hand. But one thing you'll find if you keep looking at all those cells is that you'll find the same DNA in each cell. Likewise, what are the components of a sensory experience that, if you studied them, you might lose track of hearing the bird chirp? If we could unravel the quote-unquote molecular structure of our sensory experience, what would it be made of? And is there something in common to all of our sensory experiences? Is there some metaphorical equivalent to DNA that forms each of our sensory experiences and also forms not just the experience, but being aware of our own experience? What enables us to be able to reflect on our sensory experience? Well, for the purposes of this episode, I will say yes. I'm going to tell a story about some DNA-type molecule-ish metaphorically in our consciousness thing that is found in each and every mental construction. Some baseline, bottom-level thing that's used to build up everything that we sense, everything that we think about, everything that we're aware of, everything we are conscious of. And in just a moment, I will do my best to describe this fundamental aspect. But before doing that, let's take a step back and put our consciousness in a context. I don't believe the whole universe is just dead and somehow all these molecules and atoms and everything adds up to a brain and then all of a sudden consciousness emerges somehow from the brain. I think consciousness is in everything. Consciousness is everything. Anyway, that's my particular way of going about understanding things, so that's how I start. The consciousness that develops in a human, the consciousness that becomes a human mind, emerges from this universal consciousness. So as it emerges from the universal consciousness, the very first action has to be somehow to separate, to individuate. Consciousness must separate from the universal in order to become an individual. What becomes the individual will always, ultimately, be an aspect of the universal consciousness, manifesting as a separate individual consciousness, just like a wave is always going to be part of the ocean. But let's imagine a timeless flash of a moment, just one little timeless moment, where this consciousness is neither the universal nor the individual. It is not any longer, strictly speaking, the universal, because it has somehow left the universal to become an individual. And inside this timeless moment, it has not yet started manifesting as an individual. It's kind of hanging between the two. And I will say, for the sake of this story, please remember it's a story, that this timeless moment, when we are neither the universal nor separated enough to be an individual, this is a moment that gives birth to confusion. We emerge thereafter from that confusion as individuals, but we emerge as individuals who feel something is missing. We feel something lacking. The DNA of our individuality is coded with a shadow of a sliver of a memory of our universal origin. It's in there somewhere, but 99.9% of our DNA that's in our consciousness is now coding for the individuality. It's building the individuality. So as individuals, we are born, obviously, as infants with just the rudimentary animal consciousness that all similar animals have. But our physical DNA and our mental DNA is there to grow, and it develops eventually into an adult human consciousness. We will, along the way, learn language and thus be able to create symbolic representations of much of what we perceive. Our consciousness will be able to represent money and time and the names of places we live, and we're going to be able to join in a whole culture of representing things, including representing ourselves to ourselves. But this missing piece, this missing little sliver of something off, this is what arises when the individual experiences him or herself as totally separate from the universal. The missing piece results in the individual perceiving and representing all things as separate, completely separate from him or herself. And so a search begins, a search to find what is missing. As individuals feeling separate from the world, we don't know where else to look for the missing piece other than in the world we find all around us. Or perhaps we'll find the missing piece in the inner world we find ourselves experiencing. Maybe there's some inner quiet or some state of being that will fill in what is missing. This search within the world or within myself, this search for the missing piece has enormous ramifications for our consciousness and for understanding our attention. This is because the way our attention normally functions without any particular training is the way it functions is that we keep one eye on our life as we are living it. We can cross streets safely, we can feed ourselves, we can have memories of the past, fantasies of the future. We can do anything and everything people do as they normally do when they pay attention in their lives. That's one eye's baseline. But we also keep one eye on the search. In other words, our attention is forever divided. We pay attention to our life, and sometimes we're also aware of the search and kind of overlay the search onto our life. And we might experience that as a yearning. But even if we're totally focused on something in our life and it feels like both eyes are on our life, that search for the missing piece continues in the deepest levels of our consciousness. Like I said, sometimes outside our awareness. So what is this thing we pay attention to? I've called it something missing, but that's not quite all of it. In addition to the thing that's missing, there's, let's call it our solution. Let's call it our current way of understanding what it would take to fill in what was missing. We are always co-imagining not only that something's missing, but what it's going to take to fix what's wrong. And I'm going to insert parenthetically here, nothing is actually wrong. It's just that we feel something's wrong because something appears to be missing because of that initial moment of confusion. But it isn't actually missing. Nothing's missing. Our integral and intimate participation in all that is happening all the time. We just aren't aware of it because of the way our consciousness forms, because of this initial DNA of confusion, we haven't learned how to be both an individual and a universal being. So even though there's no actual problem, we act as if there's a huge and very real problem. End parentheses. Because we see things from our individual point of view, we take what happens very personally. We are partial. We want such and such to happen instead of this or that. We pick and choose, and we really like certain things and really dislike others. It's as if our personal dislikes and our personal likes were important. We find them essential in some universal way. But if you think about it for a moment, the whole universe is unfolding as it is. But we have each somehow come to believe that we have opinions about things that are more important than anyone else's opinions. My little opinion is much more important than your little opinion. My sense of individual self is true. My sense of my opinions, I mean, certainly I have them. That's true. My individual self is true. But it's out of balance with any universal reality. This imbalance leads my opinions to form so that the world looks to me like something is wrong with the world itself, or maybe with me. Somehow there was a mistake made somewhere. I feel the tension of me and the world being out of balance, of being incorrect, of being imperfect. And I want to right things. I want to correct things. I want to finally resolve where this tension comes from. I don't know where exactly, but it's a tension that makes me fidget. I must keep on the move, either with my actions or at least I have to keep my mind moving. I'm always looking. I'm always looking for the something that will help alleviate this tension. And so here we are. And what I'm saying is that in addition to the quote-unquote normal ways we focus on the present and the normal ways we think about the past and the future, we also have some slice of our attention always focused on this quest for this solution. One very deep part of our attention is always tracking, am I getting closer? Or am I getting farther away? It's like that game of you're getting warmer, warmer, you're getting colder, colder. It's like we're always doing that with life itself somehow. If I get a promotion at work, maybe I meet someone I fall in love with, I win the lottery. Those are certainly things that are going to feel great. But then I also think things are going my way, which they are, at least for that moment. But I also add in that feeling of feeling closer to my goal of finding the missing piece. Or perhaps if I get fired, I lose the person I love, maybe all my money gets stolen. All of that's going to feel terrible. Plus, I'm going to feel farther from any solution, from any attempt to ultimately resolve all the tension. I keep making pictures, or at least having some vague sense of what would do it for me. What would solve this underlying tension of looking for this missing piece? My solutions change over time as I change, but they're all focused on the final relief of this tension, the final accomplishment of my arriving at some mode of being where I don't have to experience this tension anymore. I don't want to feel any longer like some mistake has been made. There's some kind of lost paradise I feel I must return to. So I may picture this paradise explicitly, or it may remain vague, but I'm convinced there is a paradise somewhere, and I search for the key to this paradise. While I am searching, my picture of the key must necessarily take the form of something I already know about. My key must resemble something I'm already familiar with. However I imagine my paradise, however specific or vague it is, it's going to essentially be similar to things I already know about and can name. And since I can only imagine the key as what I am already familiar with, all my efforts towards getting the key will be things I can do within my environment or within my inner world. This can only result in the world as I know it perpetuating itself. The way I know things, with me searching for the missing key, can only continue as is. My dualistic world of subject and object will always remain intact, since I am continually a subject picturing a key somewhere out there. So even though there's no way a search within this world can result in finding the actual key, there is still something true and right about me expecting something other than what this world can offer. There is something archetypally correct about thinking there's a heaven or a paradise. There's some awakening that is not of this world. Except, of course, it is of this world. Where else could it be? Nirvana is always found where samsara is. But we need some way to escape a complete individual identification with our world, because we're not completely individuals. We need to escape being trapped in our dualism, because we're not only dualistic. We humans are not limited to always being a subject who looks out at an alienated world of things I will always be separate from. I do need to identify a key, kind of, and look for a key, kind of. We have to get more specific about what the problem actually is. It's good that I imagine my key to be beyond this world. It gets me out of expecting something from this world that this world can never give. So my normal beginning search within the world for something, that's a good start. So now I need to exhaust my search. I need to see clearly there is no particular change in my dualistic perception that's going to alleviate this problem for me. My search has been correct, but by looking within reality as I know it, I have been searching incorrectly, and I'm including anything that can be imagined. The heaven, the paradise, somewhere beyond the earth, that's just me imagining things, like I can imagine going to the beach tomorrow. I can imagine a lot of things, but my imagination is just part of the mechanisms of consciousness that we are forced to deal with. We have to deal with our consciousness as it is, as it actually works. So now it becomes important to understand why my expectation of a new world cannot come to pass. Why not? There is an aspect of my search that's been giving me a problem without my realizing it. Let's review. The problem, let's say it started when I imagined this key, this solution to my problem. I imagined my paradise in dualistic terms. I imagined the separate me somehow discovering the key. I imagined the key as some final tranquility or some equilibrium or some awakening that takes place in this world, needing the forms of the world to manifest. I imagined the perfection I was seeking in terms of my own partiality for what would represent perfection for me personally. So here's the problem. I always imagined that key in my future. So the very personal nature of my search creates a new aspect of the problem that I'm just discovering. It's that I've always imagined finding the key in my future. The key in my future means that my future is somehow uphill. I somehow must travel to the future. I must get to the future where I can find the key. the present moment, it's kind of downhill. And I have to struggle upwards. I have to struggle towards something better, towards this thing that's going to alleviate my problems. I can see I have always been climbing towards this future in some way. I've always needed to make some effort to move towards the future where I can find the key. This is a mistake. The key cannot be found anywhere but in a present moment. That's because the universal and the individual are always meeting and manifesting in a present moment. All the futures we imagine are all fantasies, even the most grounded of predictions. And this key we're looking for, it's never going to be found in the future, and yet that's where I have always imagined it. I have to imagine it there. It has to be in my future because it's so clear that in my present, I sure don't have any key with me right now. I look around, I see the same old shit I always see. Perfection is clearly not in my immediate vicinity. And my past didn't have it, so where else could it be but the future? So that's why we start our search by assuming the key's in the future, but it is essential at some point to recognize this is a mistake. Any finding of the key can never be in a future, particularly one that's uphill of our present, one that's the end of a struggle. Whatever any key might be, it can only be in a moment of unity between the individual and the universal, which is already happening all the time. There's nothing that needs to be done to prepare for a future where they are united, since the individual and the universal are already united. The mistake of looking for the key in the future distorts any present view of any future or of any present. It makes us think an effort is required for the future to unfold properly. We want the future to hurry up and get here so we can be closer to the key. So this means we often discount and distort the present moment. Our looking for the key in the future also distorts the past. When we remember a good time in our past, we always remember it more fondly than what it was at the time. This is because our memories leave out the skewed view of the future we had when we were actually living at that time. That's why nostalgia is such a big business. When we recall the past, we leave out this weird view of the future being uphill. We leave out how we wanted that time to pass faster and how we didn't really appreciate that present when we were living it. But now we can look back and appreciate that time since it's in the past. So we get nostalgia and honor the past in a way we were unable to feel at that time. What all of this leads to is understanding that this key, this paradise that we're looking for, cannot be conceived of. You cannot make any mental construction of it because all our mental constructions are made of things we already know. We can only have ideas that are variations of things we have already thought of. Whatever I'm imagining as a key cannot come to pass as a key. I will never be able to purify the good and remove all the evil. I will never be able to make people act the right way and never be wrong, according to my standards. I'll never be able to arrange the world so my ideas of peace and harmony prevail, and there's never any fighting or disharmony. Whatever I imagine as the key must remain unthought of. It must remain something I cannot picture to myself. The fact that I can't picture it to myself, well, that's just always true. What I have to do is become accustomed to the fact. I have to become accepting of the fact that I can't picture it. My representation of my key can then start to evolve into something I cannot imagine. It must be different from anything I can possibly know. This lack of any picture forms a new expectation, but it's not an expectation of the future. It's not an expectation I can picture. It's not like any expectation that I've ever had. My new expectation cannot exist at all in my surface consciousness. I cannot pay attention to it. I cannot focus my attention on this new expectation because there is no thought that can represent it. And because there's nothing to pay attention to, there can be no thought about it. No thought that is accurate about it. My new expectation is somewhere in my consciousness, but I cannot, in my surface consciousness, know where. My old expectation, the way I used to think of paradise, that still remains. I still find myself imagining this or that as a totally desirable way the future might bring me my key. That's my habit, and it continues. It may take me more or less time to see through this and to let go of my old expectations. It's like one part of me offers up the old expectation and another part of me knocks it away. As I remember, the true key cannot be named or described. My relationship with my future becomes different somehow as my new expectation grows. It grows outside my awareness, since I can't imagine it, but it starts to balance out my old expectation, and I find myself expecting less and less from the world. I expect less and less that anything, any event from the world, any internal phenomena, I just expect less and less that any of these things will hold the key. This key I had spent so much time looking for. Where could it be? I don't know. I just find myself being where I am, doing what I do, expecting less and less for any particular thing to provide the key. This game of warmer, warmer, cooler, cooler, that game, how I keep track of things, it may also start to change. Am I getting closer? Am I getting farther away? I still have strong feelings of liking certain things and not liking others, but I take them less and less as indicators of, am I getting closer? Am I getting farther away? I stop expecting the world to conform to my ideas of how it should be in order to manifest my key. So, in a way, as this progresses, I no longer am expecting myself to find some thing as the key. The future, of course, doesn't disappear, but it fades as the place where I look for the key. I find myself awaiting something that can only exist in this present moment. I realize what I am awaiting is in some way no different from the present moment itself. In some ways, what I await is the pure expectation itself. My expectation no longer looks to the future. My expectation no longer looks anywhere but where my attention is right now. Where else could this key have ever been but right in front of me? Attention, attention, attention. What does this mean, attention? Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time. Please visit the home of the 10 Crutches podcast at 10crutches.link. That's 10crutches.link. The book that inspired the podcast, a book I wrote called 10 Crutches for Walking in the Present, is available for free download on the website. While you are there, please take advantage of two ways to contact me. You can send me an email, or you can make a voice recording. If you have a great question, I may be able to use it for the podcast. Also on the website, you can visit the archive to hear any published episode and see show notes for any and every show. Thanks so much for listening. And once again, thanks so much for listening. And I won't say it once again. See you next time.